News in Washington. I'm Sue Goodwin.
Escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, December 13th, 2024. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on the 35th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Panama in 1989 and how it still remains relevant to both Panama and U.S. foreign policy today. So we have a fantastic show with us today, and we're joined today by Michael Fox, who's a freelance writer, producer, and documentarian. He's the host of both Brazil on Fire and Under the Shadow. We'll be speaking a lot about his episode on the U.S. invasion of Panama. But Michael Fox, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And also joining us today is Egberto Willis, who's the host of Politics Done Right, which airs on Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston, Texas. He's also an Afro-Panamanian who has his own insights to what we'll be discussing today. So welcome back to the show, Egberto Willis.
It's always my pleasure to be with you, Oscar. I love your program and I love what you're doing in the community.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. So I'll be honest with you guys. It's hard to know where to begin with a story like this that is as vast as it is in terms of its human toll and criminality. And well, I guess the best way to start this program, speaking of criminality, let's begin by hearing the words of former President George H.W. Bush in his justification of the U.S. invasion of Panama. And it sounded a little bit like this.
Last night, I ordered U.S. military forces to Panama. No president takes such action lightly. This morning, I want to tell you what I did and why I did it. For nearly 2 years, the United States, nations of Latin America and the Caribbean, have worked together to resolve the crisis in Panama. The goals of the United States have been to safeguard the lives of Americans, to defend democracy in Panama, to combat drug trafficking, and to protect the integrity of the Panama Canal Treaty. Many attempts have been made to resolve this crisis through diplomacy and negotiations. All were rejected by the dictator of Panama, General Manuel Noriega, an indicted drug trafficker.
This was the official story from Bush himself. Now, here's a clip from Under the Shadow, produced by Michael Fox.
The largest U.S. invasion since Vietnam, the first U.S. military action since the fall of the Berlin Wall 1 month before, the testing ground for the Iraq wars. And the United States government and the mainstream media ignored or whitewashed the violence. The story told to the American people was that of a tremendous success, the liberation of the people of Panama, all in the name of democracy and the so-called war on drugs.
to defend democracy in Panama, to combat drug trafficking, and to protect the integrity of the Panama Canal Treaty.
So that was a clip from Under the Shadow, the U.S. invasion of Panama in 1989. And I just have to say, it kind of blows my mind still that we are now this month, this December, on the 35th anniversary of this invasion. I was just turning 11 when this happened, so I'm showing my age here. But like I said before, I had a hard time, Michael, processing as to where do we begin in discussing this moment in Latin American history that is both well-documented yet often ignored in the lessons it offers. So where do we begin here? This is sort of the assessment that I make of this historic event in Latin American history, that we have it documented, but we don't learn from it at the same time either.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. And I think it's important to understand, within the context of U.S. imperialism, within the context of continual invasions and the United States pushing its agenda abroad, what this represented, kind of what we mentioned in a second, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, it was the so-called end of the Cold War. The United States needed to show its power, and particularly Bush needed to show that he was strong, or at least he wanted to. And so this was a way of the United States, and particularly Bush, showing that he was not going to be weak, and he was going to be strong against those evil dictators, quote unquote. And so Panama was an easy target. Of course, this was all within the context of the so-called war on drugs, right? That, like, fit with the same promotion the United States was pushing over television and in poor communities in the United States. And so abroad, it was an easy frame to shift away from the Cold War and to continue with the messaging of saying the United States, oh, it's no longer the Cold War, but now it's the war on drugs. And so it's an easy way for the United States to be able to use that as a wedge to continue to push hard against anybody it wanted to. I mean, they're still using the same thing anywhere, right? We've seen in Plan Colombia, and we've seen the war on drugs throughout Central America, throughout Mexico. It's been the same discourse we've been using over the last decades, right? And so this was an easy target. Again, also Manuel Noriega, remember, this was a former U.S. asset. Like, he was literally on the payroll. And the only reason why the United States didn't like him anymore, because he was playing many different sides. And of course, this was a place, Panama, where the United States had literally occupied for decades, like throughout the entire 20th century. So this is not a place that the United States is going to lose, but it's a place that the U.S. can show force and can take advantage of this moment to say, look, we are not going to back down. Yes, we've won the Cold War, but now we are going to win the war on drugs. And I think that that is really important context. And yes, we have absolutely forgotten it. But it's the United States playing the same imperialist game it has always played, and using the discourse of so-called democracy and democracy promotion, when in reality, it's all pushing its own agenda abroad for its own political purposes. And in particular, in the case of George W. Bush, who at that moment needed a victory, needed a win, he needed to show strength. And this is how he did it.
Yeah, Noriega can be argued as almost the original Juan Orlando Hernandez. But even then, that's sort of a misnomer, because there have been plenty of Noriega and Juan Orlando Hernandez type figures throughout Latin American history in the 20th century alone. Egberto Willis, you're an Afro-Panamanian. I know this hits near and dear to your heart, especially on this 35th anniversary. The same question applies. Where do we begin to process this moment in history that, again, simultaneously is well-documented, but we don't learn the lessons from this well-documented event in Latin American history?
What is amazing with the story is it has so many different angles, right? Noriega was the perfect capitalist for the United States, okay? He was a capitalist. America had a need for drugs, and he was the one facilitating drugs to come to America. But the thing about it is there was a duality here. The purpose of the invasion wasn't solely about that shot in Panama City. It wasn't necessarily about drugs. As, you know, as Michael just said, it had a lot to do with power. They wanted to make sure that Noriega remained the puppet of the United States and do whatever they wanted. They wanted him to invade Nicaragua. I said no. They then used the drug as a pretext to come in. But the other side that is so disconcerting, and I tie a parallel between this, and I don't want to change your subject, but even with Gaza, we cannot tell Gaza or tell Israel to stop bombing the you-know-what out of Gaza when what Bush did in Panama was to level Chorrillo, a place filled with Panamanians who looked like me, as well as Colon. He spared everything else. I mean, there were other places that, you know, assuming you really wanted to protect yourself against folks, there was no reason to go into Chorrillo and Colon the way he did. It just showed a disregard for humanity, just like Israel has shown a disregard for humanity in Gaza. But I tell you further, they did the same thing that they've done all over the place. They've tested it. They used that invasion as well as another purpose to test new weapons systems. So that one invasion was not only devastating to Panama, but it showed the inhumanity of what we call our military that we use as an example around the world. We don't have the moral character at all to put down anybody who goes to war. That war was unnecessary. It was terrible. And to get one man, the UN says 1,000 people, I believe it was what they said. The UN said 4,000. America said 1,000. But we know how the tenements are laid out in Colon and Chorrillo. Was a hell of a lot more than got killed out there.
I have to say that the comparison between Panama and Gaza is really not off the subject because, as a matter of fact, one of Michael's guests on Under the Shadow actually made the comparison between Panama and Gaza today. And as a matter of fact, I have that clip here, and, well, let's take a listen.
Historian Olmedo Belucci says the region looked like Gaza today. He published the first book about the U.S. invasion of Panama to mark the one-year anniversary of the attack. He says some residents sought refuge in a nearby church. He says the United States promoted a strategy of looting supermarkets and stores to generate chaos and confusion. The financial cost to the private sector was estimated at $400 million.
I got you covered.
It took the United States 4 days to find Noriega, during which time the U.S. occupied the country and swore in a puppet government on a U.S. military base. The new U.S.-backed president was Guillermo Indara, the opposition candidate who had allegedly won elections earlier that year against Noriega's ally. So General Noriega, the de facto leader of Panama since 1983, had canceled the vote. Professor Olmedo Belucci explains that although Indara had participated in the elections, his was a puppet government because he was sworn in on a U.S. military base while the country was under invasion.
So that's another clip from Under the Shadow discussing the 1989 U.S. invasion of Panama. And I'll begin this question here with you, Egberto, because Michael mentioned here the issue of chaos and confusion by the U.S. military. Since you had family down there during that time, I'm curious to know if you could give us a few examples, a few further examples of the chaos and confusion that was created during that time period. I know that there are several examples there, but considering that you have family there during that time period, I want to know if you could elaborate on this. I know there was a lot to process in that clip, especially with the Indara puppet government. Mm-hmm. But can you address this issue first, if you like?
Let me tell you, and this is very interesting. Most people don't know this. Our money in Panama is called the Balboa, but the Balboa is indexed directly to $1. And so we don't even print the Balboa hardly. We just use the American dollar. And the way that Bush started to come after Noriega to try to get the government to topple is that he stopped all dollars from circulating into Panama's banks. So therefore, people had no money. They got paid. Now, the only people that had dollars were the people who worked for the Canal Zone. Luckily, my father had worked for the Canal Zone for some time, and his retirement money was going into his particular account, and they had dollars. So the Panamanians who worked for the Canal, they were like kingpins, right? Because they could go into the town, and people would pay premiums for using those dollars. So people suffered. Commerce really came to a halt. People used IOUs, pieces of paper that says, I owe you this and I'll pay you when the situation gets better. So it was utter chaos. So on the economic side, before the invasion actually occurred, there was a whole lot of mental angst that the people were going through, both economically. they were doing all these kinds of simulated attacks and that sort of thing. The American government actually was. They don't tell you about that, but they were having these simulated attacks to try to entice the Guardia Nacional, which is the Panamanian Defense Force. They were trying to get them to go ahead and somehow attack the United States to give them a purpose to come in. And they never bit. They never bit because they understood what was happening. And that's why you see Noriega did what he did. But let me tell you a few things that kind of goes on top of what Michael was talking about. This is how bad things were. My father lived in a town called Arco East, which is on the outside of Colón. And there's one street to get into Colón from Arco Iris at that time. And there were people who were stuck in Arco Iris. It was called Rainbow City as well. People who were stuck there, and they would have the tanks all blocking the entrance into Colón. One of the people my father knew, his wife had diabetes and she was trying to get her the medicine in Colón. And we had the army over there who knew nothing about Spanish. And this guy's in his hands in Spanish saying, "Necesito llevar la insulina a mi esposa. I need to carry the insulin to my wife." And he's walking up and they're saying, "Stop, stop, stop." And when he said, "But she has to have it," they gunned him down and killed him. That was the norm. That was a norm. We have a building called the 15 Pisos in Colón. All right. They used the C-1, the gunship, the C-130 gunship. And they just opened up on the building, the 15 Pisos. They had the Cobras, I think it was, sending missiles into the, because they said they were small shots coming out of the building. It was reported that the stealth fighter, not bomber, was actually just kind of played around, I guess, to test it out there. Like, for what? We don't even have a radar to try to detect it. Or missiles to hit it.
My goodness. It's just another example of how the free movement of capital undermines democracy. Michael, there's a lot that Egberto mentioned there. And I don't have this clip, but you did point out the language barrier between U.S. troops and the Panamanian citizens during the invasion. I wish I had that clip because it's one of the few times I've heard Under the Shadow that I can clearly hear the anger in your voice of the fact that U.S. troops were sent there with little to no understanding of basic Spanish whatsoever. And so considering what Egberto just brought up here, I wonder if you could elaborate on this, because that certainly lent itself to the chaos and confusion as you described in Under the Shadow.
It's just so disrespectful. I mean, doing an invasion is disrespectful, right? Doing an invasion is terrifying, but particularly an invasion in a country that they've already occupied for, at this point, 80 years. And the fact that they don't even, like, people there can't even speak Spanish. There's a couple of clips in videos that I used in Under the Shadow, I think that you were mentioning, Oscar, in which the guys are trying to get somebody to leave their house, and they're screaming at them in English. Put your hands up. Come out, you know, with your hands up. At another point, there's another guy who's blindfolded and they can't even find a translator to, like, understand what this guy's trying to say. And he's just scared for his life. He doesn't know what's going to happen. They can't even speak his language. It's mind-blowing the level of not being prepared for something this level, something this shocking. And I think to take it to another level, it's a sign of the dehumanization that happens not just during war, which does, but also that the United States has continually seen the other as. And in here we have a situation where even though the United States has occupied Panama at this point in the 1980s for 80 years, it's seen as the canal zone is the dignified, the advanced, the developed country in the world, and everything else is just savage, forest land, and, oh, those are the people that work for us, right? Those are the people that work our special canal zone. And it's this dehumanization that I think, Egberto, you were also mentioning beforehand, where we're talking about how, like, the level of disrespect and the level of, whereas someone is saying, listen, my wife needs insulin, and there's not even an understanding of, oh, maybe there might be... They're not treating other people as humans. They're treating them as or enemy or as literally just pawns, just things that we can just do away with because we can do anything we want to. And to kind of hammer this home for a second, I was really shocked in some of these videos that were passed to me. And this wasn't the first time. I'm not the first person to see these videos that came out. This was one of the first times where the U.S. military actually went in with video cameras and they videotaped themselves. And then I don't remember how these videotapes got out or released, but they were somehow passed to people in Panama. And there's numerous of these videotapes. So it is an interesting time because, of course, this is before social media and whatnot. And these videotapes, there are very little record of the U.S. invasion, if not for the own United States that actually filmed themselves. And it's interesting because they're just so candid because it's their friends that are filming each other. But it's also like they're laughing at the destruction of El Chorrillo when they're talking about, woohoo, we hit this place and it's all on fire and the whole thing is going down. They're not just talking about military barracks. They're talking about people's homes. They're talking about the entire region. And it's shocking because these are the soldiers that are doing the bombing. These are the people that are firing the weapons. Right. At one point, the guys are kind of joking around. They're, oh, you're a stud. You guys are just studs. You know, like they're joking around at the death of people. Thousands of people are being killed. People's home, 20,000 homes are destroyed and people have to flee. So many people injured, like families destroyed and cut off, and all at the hands of the U.S. government and soldiers just joking. And what's frightening here is this is something that happens again with Abu Ghraib. It's something that happens over and over. We see it in the Middle East. This doesn't change. Like the attitude within the U.S. military continues. The U.S. invasions, the same attitude within the army. And so I think this is really important to point home, which maybe I don't dig into enough. I do get angry. You're totally right. In the End of the Shadows series, I am pissed. Because it's not just the level of, oh, here's the U.S. government and they're doing this. But in this case, you see this really subtle, humanized reality of the soldiers themselves that are doing this, and yet they're laughing at it. Mm-hmm. And yet they're dehumanizing Panamanians who have lost their families and who have their back against the wall and are being invaded by another country. And they've already faced this U.S. enclave and this U.S. invasion that's invaded their country for nearly a century. And I think that this is something that it hasn't changed. And I think this is really important to remember on the 35th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Panama.
If I may add, because what you said is so true, but what is so hurtful and disconcerting is how they also treated the bodies. And, you know, very few people saw this. They just dug holes and there are places in Panama when the destruction in Chorrillo, there are a lot of people that just buried underneath there. They are all there with the crap. Nobody tried to discern bodies or anything like that. They just used a bulldozer and just went over it. I mean, let's go under the pretext that Bush was really concerned about drugs. The same issue that we see with Mexico, where Donald Trump tries to go ahead and say, we're going to throw tariffs on you guys, etc. I wish we would have more responses like the Mexican president responded, like, by the way, do you realize if your guns didn't come over here, we wouldn't have a lot of killings? Do you realize that if your people didn't need all those drugs, we wouldn't have that transfer of drugs? It's not Mexicans that have the problem. It's you. And the same applies to when we had Manuel Antonio Noriega. The problem wasn't with Panama and the Panamanians. The problem was you're the ones that had all these drug problems, and you are the one that a capitalist took advantage of to provide you with the supply you were looking for. And it behooved me that to date, America hasn't seen that it's America who has the drug problems that creates all these externalities.
Precisely. And I mean, even Claudia Sheinbaum, I think, should mention, you know, former Secretary of Public Security in Mexico, Genaro García Luna, as sort of another Noriega, Juan Orlando Hernández type of character that the U.S., you know, gladly supports when it's convenient and then put in jail when it's no longer convenient. And I have to say that I find it quite fascinating that when I asked Egberto about chaos and confusion in Panama, one of the first things that came up was the economics of the country, which goes to show you that the troops weren't ready to speak Spanish in Panama, but the U.S. government was prepared to attack the country economically. And as a matter of fact, Michael, I think you mentioned that there were economic sanctions on Panama before the invasion, which was foretelling. Now, You mentioned the comparison between Gaza, and I want to see if you could briefly clarify this for me, Michael, is that when Olmedo Beluche made that comparison between Panama and Gaza, I'm curious to know, when did he say that? What was the time period when he said that? Because I don't know if he could have foreseen how things have become since then, since he made those comments.
So that was exactly 1 year ago when I spoke with him. It was last December. And so obviously Israel had already invaded Israel, and you know, they had already pushed back. Things were already bad. They were not as obviously not as bad as that is right now. But the situation, the image that you have of Gaza and the image of El Chorrillo is very, very similar. And so, yeah, that wasn't far into the past. That was under this current moment as well.
And it's certainly relevant to a previous show we did several weeks ago with regards to why Latin America has found solidarity of what's taking place in Gaza, and countries like Panama that has its unique frame of reference is precisely that reason. And there are other countries in Latin America to various degrees that have that similar frame of reference as well, which explains the solidarity with Gaza as we speak today. So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Michael Falx, who's a freelance writer, producer, and documentarian. He's also the host of both Brazil on Fire and Under the Shadow. And we're also speaking with Egberto Willis, who's the host of Politics Done Right, which airs on Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston, Texas. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned. That was Ruben Blades, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about the 35th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Panama with Michael Falx, who's a freelance writer, producer, and documentarian. He's also the host of both Brazil on Fire and Under the Shadow. And we also have Egberto Willis, who's the host of Politics Done Right, which airs on Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston, Texas. Now, before I continue, I forgot to mention earlier that Under the Shadow is a co-production of both NACLA and the Real News Network. So I encourage everyone to go to either one of those sites to check out more episodes of Under the Shadow. Now, as I said before, Panama is both well-documented yet under-reported as far as the lessons that need to be learned from this moment in Latin American history. But perhaps one of the best works on the U.S. invasion of Panama is the 1992 documentary film, The Panama Deception. Mm-hmm. Almost 32 years later, it still remains a rich fountain of information on what took place in Panama. In fact, a few journalists that plied their trade on the Pacifica Network at the time were featured in the film. So I have another clip here from Under the Shadow that includes excerpts from the Panama Deception. So let's take a listen.
What happened in Panama is a hidden horror. Many of the bodies were bulldozed into piles and immolated in the slums where they were collected. Other bodies were left in the garbage chutes of the poor projects in which they died from the shooting, from the artillery, from the machine guns, from the airborne attacks. Others were said to have been pushed into the ocean.
But almost none of this was seen or heard of in the local and international press. It was hushed up, cleaned up, controlled, and locked down by the invading U.S. forces. Here's filmmaker Barbara Trent again from the Panama Deception.
The U.S. military also targeted the Panamanian media. Radio stations were immediately taken over and destroyed. U.S. forces occupied TV stations and began transmitting their own signal. Many journalists were either arrested or fired. One of Panama's largest daily newspapers, La Republica, was raided, ransacked, and closed down by American troops.
So that's another clip of Under the Shadow, which includes clips from the Panama Deception, the 1992 documentary film. So I'm presenting this question to the both of you guys. Can you tell us about the significance of this documentary film in your respective understanding of Panama's history? And I'll begin with Egberto, because even today, I've seen this film at least a half dozen times. And every time I watch it, I feel like I learned something new or something different, or see something different that I didn't see the first time. So 32 years later, how would you measure the significance of this documentary, which still remains quite good even today?
Not even Panamanians know how bad things were. I mean, in fact, you would find Panamanians today who work for the Canal Zone, who actually supported what the Americans did in Panama. Again, the same kind of deception that occurs with MAGA in the United States is the kind of stuff that you have with a lot of the Pancanal workers in Panama. And that is, they are Panamanians that the United States want to have nothing to do with except when they're working for the Canal Zone. But these people look at, it's almost like they have that syndrome, the I forgot the name of the syndrome where you fall for the attacker. Look, I think we have to first realize that Panama wasn't even Panama. Panama was Colombia. And not until America wanted to build a canal did they allow, quote-unquote, rebels to create Panama, okay? So Panama is really, yes, it did exist before as a sole country, but after being incorporated in Gran Colombia, it actually regained its status as Panama because of the United States. And if you take a look at what people believe there today, you still wouldn't find the angst that one would expect against the United States for that invasion that one would expect. It's only the elitists, that they would like to call the lefties, the elitists, that look at it and say, well, that is what occurred was really an international crime. And it's frustrating because here I am, I'm in the United States, not in Panama. And I bring these subjects up with a lot of Panamanians. And it was like, yes, Noriega was a bad guy. Actually, I don't think Noriega was any worse than most of our presidents. I hate to put it that way.
Wasn't the film banned in Panama for a time?
I'm not sure. Actually, I wasn't there, so I don't know, but it wouldn't surprise me if it were, because again, remember, these governments were puppet governments of the United States. They served at the pleasure of, as long as they did what the American government wanted them to do. And America showed them one thing: we can cut the plug anytime on your financial sector and you're screwed, you know, and they still hold that against Panama, in that you go to Panama, the biggest circulation of money is in fact the United States dollar, you know? So I think it's a problem that will never be solved, actually, because, you know, why? But again, the one thing that I do want to say is we have to take into account, and I think you mentioned this up front, that the behavior of the United States in Panama is no different than its behavior in every single part of not just Latin America or the Caribbean, but all over the world. And when we look at what Israel and any one of its satellites does, they're doing just what their master has always done. And that is, the only people that matter are the people in the quote-unquote first world countries, and everybody else is the other. You know, there's a problem when Colin Powell called what occurred in Panama with dead Panamanians collateral damage. Collateral damage. Human beings, collateral damage from a guy whose genesis was Jamaica.
Michael, it's very clearly that you got a lot of inspiration from the Panama deception for this particular episode. And I also played that clip specifically because it pointed out how the Panamanian media at that time was suppressed as well. So again, the same question applies, you know, what degree of significance would you hold this film 32 years later?
Yeah, I mean, the film was huge. I just did look it up while when you mentioned this. It was banned in Panama for a time. And in fact, it was banned on many PBS stations as well in the United States, or at least they refused to broadcast it, although some stations did do it anyway. And it was huge. Remember that this documentary came out in 92, right? The invasion was in December of 89. And so the fact that this was just a couple years later is really important. And when you watch the film, it's shocking, like the level, like the interviews they've got. I mean, it's so important because people were just on the ground. Everything is really, really new. And I mean, it won the Academy Award in 1993 for Best Documentary. And that's huge. And it also says something that the fact that it won despite being banned in Panama and despite, you know, not being pushed out on PBS stations, whatever else. It also shows like the complicity of U.S. media as well as Panamanian media within all of this. And that's why it was so important. And it is still a testament to what happened, to the reporting on the ground. Many of the people, like, for instance, the person who was interviewed that I used that clip from, he then passed away a few years later. There was somebody else who also passed away. So we're talking about people that were on the ground, that were reporting on the ground, that saw what had happened, that could tell those real stories that are no longer with us. And that's the other really important place that this holds and the testament that it is today, because it was done so soon after such devastation.
I have to say that the last time I did a show here on the Latino Media Collective on the U.S. invasion of Panama was in 2019 on the 30th anniversary. And at the time, I had the pleasure of speaking with Jose Luis Morin, who's a professor of criminal justice over at John Jay College in New York. I only mention that because I know that you spoke to a different professor, Michael, from John Jay College with regards to the legal battle in getting some degree of reparations or justice for the families of the victims of the U.S. invasion of Panama. And I'm going to start directing this question to Egberto first, because over the years, several legal organizations, both in Panama and in the U.S., have fought in court to seek some degree of justice, as I said before, for the families of the victims of the invasion. And over the years, the U.S. has disregarded the rulings of international courts of law, holding the U.S. accountable. Along the way, the trauma of those who survived the invasion remains 35 years later. So I don't know to what degree you have or hold any trauma, but without reopening any old wounds, Egberto, how do you address the issue of, I guess, for lack of a better term, PTSD, especially when the U.S. refuses any forms of reparations? You mentioned earlier in the conversation that people were just, you know, slaughtered with missiles and with all sorts of military technology that had never been seen before. I vividly remember speaking with Professor Morin 5 years ago, and he spoke about lasers. He spoke about people being collected in buckets, not in body bags. Mm-hmm. This sort of horrific stuff. And so how do we address this sort of trauma 35 years later, especially when the U.S. doesn't hold itself accountable, especially when people who were there had those images in their mind during that time?
I don't know if a lot of Americans will understand this, right? I mean, born Americans will understand this. And that is, there is a state that people in south of the border live in, which is in a constant state of a trauma that they don't know that they're in a state of trauma, okay? Because it's a constancy. It is always fending for the next day. It's always, you know, I mean, you don't expect good things to happen. You don't, I mean, you don't. So, I mean, those people that lived in Chorrillo, El Chorrillo, they were living a hellified life as it is already during the economic disaster that Bush imposed on these people. I mean, and you can say, well, economic disaster versus the carnage that they saw. The truth of the matter is, like you said, a lot of people didn't see the savagery that actually occurred. That was all insular, right? So as far as the scene, the body bags and all these things move in grand quantities, people didn't see it. Let me tell you better. When the invasion occurred, there's a place in Panama called the Free Zone, okay? The Free Zone is where all the products from around the world congregate because, you know, we are the Panama Canal, shipping containers go there, they exchange it and all of that. One of the things that came out of the invasion was the people invading the Free Zone. So as their connection, many people would drive from Panama City to Colón to go into the Free Zone. Corporate guys would go into the Free Zone to loot because that's a massive amount of products from around the world. So to them, their vision of this invasion wasn't the vision of the carnage that was within Chorrillo or was within the tenements in Colón. Everything else was fine. And so that trauma, yes, would be there. And I can only speak to the immediate folks that I know that didn't go through it. I can tell you about my father running under the bed as they stayed with the helicopters up top and the missiles were going into Colón. I can tell you about that. But after that was over, my father came and visited me yearly. And I mean, he would tell the stories every day, but, you know, it was a story. But the biggest story was what happened in the Free Zone for a lot of these people. What happened with the looting, because at once they got at the plutocracy, right? So it's a complex, I guess I have to say it's very complex what really occurred in there. As far as the PTSD, yes, there would be that, but I don't think it would be as big as we would look at it in, you know, from an American point of view.
It's certainly a Pandora's box that you can't really measure on a piece of paper or on a graph or a chart, but yet it's there, it's still relevant. And it's precisely the sort of thing that people fight the legal fights that they have almost 35 years later. I'm curious to know, Michael, if you want to elaborate on this, because as we have this conversation, even now, the International Criminal Court has made a ruling that the U.S. doesn't favor. And it just shows you how the legal battle is really against the people at the grassroots level trying to fight the good fight to try to find some degree of justice. And towards the second half of this particular episode of Under the Shadow, you addressed that as well, correct?
Yeah. I just want to kind of tag off of what you were saying, Humberto, is absolutely true. And the fact that much of the country was not witnessing everything that was happening in El Chorrillo. And part of that was because there was a media blackout, which we already talked about, right? You couldn't see it on the U.S. media. In fact, the U.S. press that was there were there kind of supported or embedded with the United States. And the United States soldiers were taking them around. Oh, look at this, look at this, look at this. They're showing what they wanted to show them. The few journalists, of the few journalists that were actually trying to show what was really happening, and I mentioned this in Under the Shadow too, you had, and I don't remember his name, but he was a Spanish photojournalist. He was one of the first people that took pictures of body bags of people that had been killed. And in fact, the United States soldier shot him, and he died within the first couple of days after the invasion. Juancho, I think, was his name, if I'm not mistaken. And so that's exactly, the media blackout was meant to block the vision of what was happening, to ensure that people didn't see what was going on in Colón and El Chorrillo and whoever else. And to people, in fact, there were other people around the country that were celebrating, yay, the United States is coming to liberate us and to free us and whatnot. So I think that is a really important point, understanding what this means now. And then, you know, in terms of justice, you know, absolutely, there were many people that I interviewed for this episode. And there were many other people that I wanted to interview for this episode who were victims or who lost family members. And there were some people that said, look, I'm just not interested in being interviewed. And that was because they'd been interviewed so many times. And because in the early years, they thought that it would mean they would get justice.
Mm-hmm.
They thought that this will mean that I can finally have some sort of a peace and I can find justice for my brother or sister or relative or whoever it was that was passed. And now they've been interviewed so many millions of times and justice has not come. And they say, you know, mm-hmm. I'm just tired. I just can't. And that's a reality for many people in Panama. The fact that the OAS, Human Rights Council, would come out and say, United States, it was the very first time that they had an international, this international council came out and actually held the United States accountable and said, no, the United States is responsible. And in fact, the United States should be paying damages to everyone for mm-hmm. everything within Panama. That's huge. This is the first time it's ever happened that within the OAS, within the human rights, they said that another country is actually responsible for this happening in Panama. And yet the United States has just turned a blind eye. They've just completely ignored it and said, you know what? We do not care because we are above international law.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really important for people to understand because the United States is seen as, oh, the greatest democracy in the world. It's seen as, oh, you know, having the greatest laws and defending the great, you know, and it's just not true. The U.S. will only defend that if it means that they're going to win on an international court. They're mm-hmm. never going to stand by it if they actually lose. And that's why they don't want to participate in the ICC and the International Criminal Court, because they don't want to have their people accountable, mm-hmm. right? They don't mind being on the accusatory end of it. They know we're not going to be on the defensive end of mm-hmm. it, right? And no, it's devastating. At the same time, it is important, the fact that those things have happened, that the council said, no, sorry, you are responsible. That is an incredible precedent. But the fact that the United States turns its back on this is huge and just devastating for us to remember what the United States represents. We always have to, it's like, we know what it represents. And yet in this case, it's so glaring. It's so in your face. It's just shocking.
And it's very consistent with what Jose Luis Morin told me 5 years ago when I interviewed him on the 30th anniversary. We are almost out of time, but I have one clip left that I think sort of gives us a reason why this still matters 35 years later. And it's another clip from Under the Shadow, which brings up the issue of gentrification. So let's take a listen.
That is what they want to bring here, gentrification, says Efrain. And the people don't know what's happening because this term isn't really known here in Panama. And I'm trying to kind of wake people up. You can already see the change in the neighboring community, pretty buildings and things. And then you come here and things are kind of falling apart, he says. Because at the end of the day, gentrification isn't just a process of urban displacement, but of degrading a region enough to put social pressure on the community itself so that it has to leave, he says. Efrain explains that public transportation, schools, trash pickup, and basic services have been gutted in El Chorrillo in recent years. He says it's all part of a push to force people to leave so real estate prices will tank and developers can move in to cash in big. Efrain says his tours are a way of trying to help revive the community's connection to the past.
So the issue of gentrification seems like the best final question here as to why the U.S. invasion of Panama still matters 35 years later. So we have a few minutes left. I'll give a minute to each of you to tell me, you know, why it matters. Segueing from that, why it still matters 35 years, the U.S. invasion of Panama. Michael?
Yeah. I mean, the legacy is devastating. And again, we see the destruction of El Chorrillo, but this time to push in developers and big businesses and everything else. And I want to even connect this even further into the past. And, you know, maybe Egberto might want to speak to this a little bit, but the whole idea of the U.S. occupation of the Canal Zone, it was creating a segregated apartheid system, right? That goes back to the beginning of the 1900s. I mean, This is the legacy, and this is what the U.S. invasion comes out of. And you can't piece one thing and separate one thing from another. It's all intertwined, right? So it is devastating. The legacy is devastating. And the history of what the United States has represented, look at the system that it tried to export abroad in Panama. It is shocking. And this is the system that, in part, the U.S. invasion was trying to keep in place. That was part of the reason for the U.S. invasion. It was because of Manuel Noriega. It was because the United States wanted to show force. But it was also because the United States wanted Panama to pull back from having to hand over the U.S. canal zone back to Panama, right? So it wants to keep all this in place. It's shocking and it's devastating. And we need to remember this legacy today and continue to fight against it.
And that explains why there's a second episode exclusively on the Panama Canal. So, Egberto, you got the last word.
Yeah, let me just tally on apartheid in the Canal Zone. The Canal Zone had the Panamanians living in one place, the Americans living in the next. Panamanians had substandard housing. The Americans had very great homes, etc. It had its own police department, judgeship, everything in the Canal Zone that had two laws in one country. When it comes to El Chorrillo and gentrification, remember this, El Chorrillo is right next to what's called La Cinta Costera. That is the highway that follows the coastline. Beautiful area, skyscrapers, everything. The first few blocks is high price. Everything is great. And behind that is El Chorrillo. Yes, they would like to get rid of that. The same thing is happening in Colón. Colón is on the Atlantic side. Colón, Portobello, all these different coastal towns that they want to turn into resorts or whatever. The only thing that they always forget is how ingenious Panamanians are. They don't give sewage, they create your own sewage system. They don't give water, they create your own water system. So it's hard as hell to move these people out of these areas because of how resourceful they are. And you know who aren't resourceful? Developers. They need the U.S. government and the military to go ahead and dump people out, like what Netanyahu is doing in Gaza to create a waterfront property. They'd turn Chorrillo into close to waterfront property, and Colón and Portobello and all these places that border the ocean into great resorts for all the people that are willing to pay. Yes, the invasion was terrible, but it also serves multiple purposes. Invasions always do that, don't they? You blow stuff up and new things come about.
I could tell just by looking at you guys that we could continue this conversation but for another hour, but it lends itself to why this is still a relevant story 35 years later. So with that said, we've been speaking with Michael Fox, who's a freelance writer, producer, and documentarian, the host of both Brazil on Fire and Under the Shadow, which are co-productions of both NACLA and the Real News Network. I encourage everyone to listen to both episodes on Panama to get a better understanding of Panama from Under the Shadow. Once again, Michael Fox, it's always fun. It's always a pleasure. Thank you for being on the show with us.
Thank you so much, Oscar. And thank you, Egberto. It's been a pleasure to be here.
That's right. We've also been speaking with Egberto Willis, who's the host of Politics Done Right, which airs on Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston, Texas. He also has a YouTube channel of the same name. Again, always fun, always a pleasure. Thank you for being on the show with us, Egberto Willis.
Look, first of all, it's always my honor to be on the program with you, Oscar. And it was also an honor to meet Michael Fox for the first time. So thank you so kindly, and thank you for the work both of you are doing. I've been talking about the independent media is what's going to be necessary going forward, not only in America, but throughout the world, because the plutocracy owns it all. Thank you guys for what you do.
Yeah,
absolutely. You got it. And with that said, that is it for today's show. You can follow us on latinomediacollector.com. You can follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. Russia launched a missile attack on Ukraine's energy infrastructure early today in an assault that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky described as one of the largest strikes on his country's power facilities. Moscow described the attack as a direct response to Kyiv's recent use of American missiles against targets inside Russia. Russia has been systematically targeting Ukraine's civilian energy infrastructure in recent months, resulting in repeated emergency shutdowns and scheduled power cuts. Around half of the country's generating capacity has been destroyed over nearly 3 years of war. Today's attack came on the coldest day of the Ukrainian winter so far, with temperatures around -6 Celsius. In other news, an Israeli strike on the densely populated Nosirat refugee camp last night killed at least 33 people as Gaza's humanitarian situation continues to deteriorate. Medics told Reuters that Israeli fire struck a postal office in Nosirat that was sheltering displaced Palestinian families as well as nearby houses. Meanwhile, President Biden's national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, who is in Israel to try to secure a ceasefire, said yesterday he is hopeful of a deal. After meeting Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Sullivan said, quote, "It might not happen, but I believe it can happen with political will on both sides," close quote. Close to 45,000 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces in Gaza since the war began last year, according to Gaza's health ministry. The health ministry says more than half of the dead are women and children. And a second motion to impeach South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol was submitted to the parliament today over Yoon's move to impose military rule on December 3rd. The South Korean opposition labeled the short-lived martial law declaration as unconstitutional, illegal rebellion, or coup. Yoon survived an initial impeachment attempt when his People Power Party boycotted the vote, preventing a quorum. Since then, at least 7 members of the People Power Party have declared their intention to support impeachment, which would bring the National Assembly closer to the 200-vote threshold to pass an impeachment motion alongside the 192 opposition party lawmakers. And in domestic news, the Justice Department announced an agreement yesterday with the city of Louisville, Kentucky, on a federal oversight plan that will require the local police department to make sweeping changes aimed at curbing excessive force and racial discrimination. The consent decree emerged more than 4.5 years after a Louisville officer fatally shot Breonna Taylor during a nighttime raid on her apartment in March of 2020. One former officer who participated in the raid and another who helped falsify the search warrant were convicted on federal charges related to the raid, while 2 others are under indictment. The consent decree, which will be submitted to a federal judge for approval, mandates that the Louisville Police Department pursue changes to use of force policies, officer training and supervision, and the handling of search warrants under the supervision of a federal monitor. And in weather today,